This is Will Corwin for Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and my guest today is the artist Oliver Herring, who will be having a task party in Madison Square Park next week, September 6th. Welcome, Oliver.
Thank you.
I want to jump right in and just start talking about what a task party is and what specifically is going to be happening.
A task party is, well, it's a piece of art, but it's also increasingly becoming a tool that can be applied towards all kinds of different ends. But I can talk more about that later. What's going to happen is we have a fantastic space. It's in Madison Square Park. A whole bunch of materials, and there'll be a large group of people. We're shooting for about 1,000 people that will come together and write tasks, which can be anything, you know, something as simple as stand on a leg to something more ambitious like start a revolution, and put that written task in a designated task pool, then pull a task from that pool and interpret it however they want with whatever or whoever is around. When they deem their task completed, they write a new task, put it in the pool, pull a new task, and so on. So over X amount of time, in theory at least, anything can happen.
Now, you've talked about these task parties as being sort of social condensers where they bring people together to activate sort of a social interaction. But so how does that begin to happen? Do people do it in groups of twos and threes, or do they do it one at a time? And do they then, can they turn and ask other people for help with their task if it's something like that?
It's a good question. There are actually no rules. So any of these variations can happen. It depends on what you try to get out of it, where your mind is when you start. But one thing is for certain, that once you get going, your threshold is going to be pushed a little bit. Your comfort zone is going to expand. And you're probably going to do things that you didn't think you'd do before you started. Mm. And that might include other people.
Yeah.
It's probably very likely to include other people.
Well, you've been preparing for this for quite a while, and you're sort of in the midst of it right now. When you say materials, like pencils, pens, what are we talking here? Props? What kind of stuff are you preparing right now? How are you getting ready for this kind of an event?
Well, this is a large-scale task party. It's, in fact, going to be the biggest task party to date.
What was the last biggest one? Just give us a sense.
The last biggest one was also here in New York, but it wasn't open to the public. It was organized for the National Art Educators Association when they had their annual conference here. So we had, over 4 hours, about 850 educators and teachers participate over the course of 4 hours. So they were not all there at the same time. I think for this one, we're expecting a lot more people at the same time. But with regards to materials, because we don't have a lot of money to put into this, which is also part of the point, mm-hmm. A lot of the organization relies on finding partners who are willing to donate whatever talents, gifts, resources they can bring to the table and convince them that this is a worthwhile effort. And in this case, we found Material for the Arts, and they're going to supply us with a lion's portion of the material. I mean, I'm working with...
Do you know what they're giving you?
I mean,
I've been to Materials for the Arts, too. It's sort of like the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's just like a giant room filled with, like, broken computer monitors and chairs and, you know, rolls of canvas and stuff.
Yeah, and fabric and string and paper.
Okay.
And
it
changes every day.
Calendars from 1987 from the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
We're probably using less idiosyncratic materials. Uh-huh. I like to focus on more streamlined general material that can be transformed in a lot of different ways, not to, you know, guide the witnesses too much.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been going there, or some interns have been going there and picking what they think is suitable for this. And usually they send me 100 JPEGs a minute, and I say yay or nay.
That's a task in itself.
It's a task in itself.
Finding stuff for 1,000 people to do anything with.
It's incredible, actually. It's really, to me, very hopeful to be able to put an event together for 1,000 people without spending money.
Mm.
You know, I think that's, to me, a lot more inspiring than if you throw in a few $100,000 and make this happen, which is much easier.
Mm-hmm. But, okay, so what is the theory behind having one person do someone else's task? What does that mean? For you?
Well, you know, the way I come into this is from, you know, for me, this is a natural extension of my studio practice, which is very experimental and open-ended. And I realized that to a lot of people, when they think of contemporary art, they think of something a lot more static, an experience like in a museum or a gallery that is somewhat choreographed, that isn't really hands-on. When I'm in the studio, I'm usually vulnerable. There is no right or wrong. I'm on my own in a way, and I have to trust my intuition. I have to sort of find, I have to find something worthwhile to do, and a lot of what I do ends up not being very good. Mm-hmm. That's part of the process. Failure is actually really important, an important part of all of this. And I realized that there are very few outlets out there that people can engage in order to tap into, you know, contemporary art that provide that kind of open-ended, totally experimental experience. And so I started to tailor a portion of my work to address that. And Task is the outlet that's perhaps, you know, that's got the most momentum right now.
Mm. And you started doing the Task parties in 2002.
Uh-huh.
How did you come up with the idea? How did that just generate itself?
It naturally grew out of my video work, actually. Uh-huh. In the summer of 2002, I engaged in another experiment where I invited I advertised for anybody to come to the studio, and we try and generate something on the spot. There was usually no plan involved at all.
How do you present that to a stranger that's just come to your studio?
Through, you know, flyers and bulletin boards and in cafes and laundromats, yeah, and word of mouth and a little bit online. 2002, there was less online action, but a little bit. So I just got the word out, and it sort of self-perpetuated. Yeah. People came.
But when they're standing there in front of you in your studio, what do you say to someone who's just arrived?
It depends on the person.
Yeah.
It really depends on their expectations and comfort zones. And I think my main job is to put people at ease, to build trust. It's mutual, you know. And so a lot of it is to put people at ease, to avoid cliches, because in a situation like that, which is somewhat stressful, it's much easier to go into your bag of tricks and fill time in a way that you know how to, and it's much harder to do something that is adventurous. So I try to build trust and just start with something, anything, you know. And based on whoever I'm working with's reaction, I can build on that. That becomes material. That becomes my vocabulary. It really doesn't matter who comes in and who, whatever they bring to the table. What matters is the limitations that they present, and then I sort of try to work within those limitations, which I've learned are limitless. You know, somebody might not want to do this and do that, and that's good. Then I know. Then mm-hmm. I can work within that. And by the end of the summer, I had worked with about 40 people and had made, edited 6 videos, which went into a show in London. And
where was that?
At a now defunct gallery called Roads and Man.
Okay.
And let's see. And I think I decided that I wanted to make sure that this sort of open-ended, anything-goes process that had brought about the videos could be conveyed to the audience. And so I decided I wanted to do something in front of a live audience in real time. And that's how I came up with Task. And the first Task party was actually with only 10 people that were found through an application process. And we did it for 8 hours, 2 days in a row, which was way too much.
Yeah, wow.
But
8 hours of the task project, of the task in the pool, bringing it out.
No, eight. These 10 people were unleashed upon each other for 8 hours straight.
And filmed?
I think there was a little filming going mm-hmm. on, but it wasn't really about that.
Yeah.
It was really just to have a live audience witness this kind of self-guided chaos.
Where was it presented?
Oh, and in a truly amazing location, in a secret Masonic temple inside the, oh gosh, what's the hotel called? There's actually a novel by, I'm blanking. Anyway, it'll come to mm-hmm. me. It's really a great writer, German writer who lives in England, who writes these travelogish kind of novels, and he also references this Masonic temple.
And so, for 2 days,
yeah.
Yeah.
But what happened was people really threw themselves into it and became, for a whole bunch of them, a very cathartic experience, and made me realize that maybe there is actually some potential in the structure that can be further tailored towards some end.
So the task party is largely about this moment of relaxation. Do you see this trajectory happening in the larger task parties where there's like the moment of awkwardness, like referencing like your personal experience where you meet them, you talk to them? Do you see like in a group of 1,000 people that they sort of are all kind of at odds and ends and then sort of begin to become more sort of harmonious with each other and then begin to work together? Is that some natural trajectory that you can watch as the...
I think there are two things that happen. One is that you come into this nervous because, and if I talk to people, they will always tell me, I'm a very shy person. I don't usually do this. And I'm definitely not an artist. Mm-hmm. So I'm not very creative. But as soon as you get there, you realize that you're not on stage. Nobody's really watching you because everybody is in the same boat. So these inhibitions that you come with flow away right away. And the second thing is that you realize intuitively, probably, that this is a very unusual situation, not just to connect with a bunch of materials and the environment that you're in, but also with other people, because these tasks become prompts for you to really engage the way you always wanted to. So if there is a very cute guy or a cute girl over there, you mm-hmm. take that task and you interpret it so you can ask that person and say, hey, I need some help with this, and the person is very likely to, to help you. So it can become this real bridge builder and wall breaker between people, and it's been applied towards that end in many situations as well.
And then there are three groupings of there's task party, task workshop, and the task workshop. So you begin to employ this as a tool. Mm-hmm. And has this been grabbed? It was sort of grabbed up by different organizations and educators and sort of corporations and just people in general seeing this as like a means of coming to results?
It's actually the larger task parties, the ones where you don't have an application process, where it's open to anyone, where you really get, where we got hundreds of people into the same space. It's those parties that became ground zero for a lot of this task action that takes place now, because a lot of these people went back into their respective communities and thought, hey, why don't we have our own task party? And what happened around 2007 or 2008 was that wherever I traveled to, I would run into people who came up to me to tell me about their task party or some task party that had been taking place in a classroom.
And a book about this came out in 2008.
That's right, 2009.
2009, sorry.
So I realized that there was actually this crossroad where I had to make up my mind whether I to rein in task and make it more mine mm-hmm. again, or to let it go. And I decided on letting it go and just sort of take on its own life, which changed my role in the process. And
This is Will Corwin for Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org. My guest today is the artist Oliver Herring. We've been talking about his task party that's going to take place in Madison Square Park on September 6th. Oliver, I want to start talking about you, not just the task party.
All right.
You're from Germany. You're from Heidelberg.
Yeah.
Which makes me think of The Student Prince, which is a great musical. And one of the interesting things I found out is that you went to an exhibition of Joseph Beuys and you saw him speak.
Uh-huh.
And I've talked to several artists from Germany, usually, who saw Beuys. And usually they sort of talk about this sort of cathartic, exciting experience. Tell me a little bit more about it. I mean, you said, well, I'll just let you talk about it.
Well, I was a teenage kid. I had many interests, and you know, Joseph Beuys, that was in the mid 80s. Was it? Could have been even in the late 70s. Can't remember. But my parents told me that there was this Joseph Beuys exhibition.
Are they artists? Or
no, not at all. I think they try to push me into all kinds of areas that turned out to be, you know, very beneficial. They introduced me to opera and dance and all kinds of other things. It wasn't really naturally what I was interested in. I was I wanted to study medicine, and I was really into sports. But I went to this exhibition. I had read a little bit about Joseph Beuys. At first, I saw the show. It was little bits of felt and fat, and I thought.
Did you go with your parents? Or
I went
yourself?
With my parents, but you know, I looked at this stuff on my own, and I thought it was so pretentious. I hated it. And then Joseph Beuys came and started to talk, and the experience that I had was just like the other people that you talk to. It was kind of cathartic because he talked about very complex stuff, but he didn't talk down. He used language that made me, as a kid who didn't really know much about contemporary art, totally get what he was talking about. He was talking to me. And suddenly I looked at the work again, and it was transformed. These works became portals for possibility.
The little bits of fat and felt and sausage and stuff.
They became signifiers for something much larger, and I thought that was so incredibly powerful. But really, for me, the thing, the tool that he sort of introduced was to find a way to communicate to people. I think that was at the heart of everything that he was doing, talking to people, getting them to do stuff. And I think one of the most undervalued contributions of his work is the formation of the Green Party, which is to a large degree built on his principles. Mm. It's something that's never really talked about, but to me it's an incredibly powerful example of how art can be more than just metaphor and simulation and aesthetics, but can have a real impact in the real world.
Mm. Have you ever considered politics yourself?
No
way. Starting your own party?
No. I stick to art.
Yeah.
That's my tool.
So you saw Joseph Beuys. Would you say that kind of invigorated your interest in doing art, or was it just sort of something wonderful that happened?
It was just something wonderful that happened, and then I eventually finished high school. I still was planning on going into medicine, but then ended up in England studying there art. Mm-hmm. But I was really it was an accident. Mm-hmm. But then I was good at
it. How was that an accident? Were at Oxford studying art.
I would have had to, right after high school, go to do military service or social service. And I had a few months to kick around. I went to a language school in England to learn English. The language school happened to be in Oxford. I looked around the university, fell in love with it, and suddenly thought, if I could somehow get into this university, maybe I could, you know, convince the military to postpone my service. So I wrote this letter and saying, I have a very good chance of getting into Oxford University of Oxford. Big honor for a German. Would you postpone my service? And to my amazement, they were flexible on this matter. So I had to get into this university. And since I couldn't speak English very well, I thought, maybe art. So long story short, I got in. And the military postponed my service. And when I finished, my graduation sort of coincided with the Berlin Wall coming down. So suddenly the Germans didn't have any need for military service anymore, because there was a large population of young men from the East who had nothing to do, mm-hmm. who really wanted to join. So they had too many people to deal with, and that made it obsolete for me. Hmm. That's how I ended up as an artist.
and then you got to New York.
Yes.
And I was curious about the Ethel Eichelberger series of works. It was something you spent 10 years of your life sort of working with or considering or making part of your practice. Tell me a little bit more about what was the fascination with Ethel Eichelberger?
I came upon his work when I was a student in England. Mm-hmm. There were two key people for me that I had overlap with. One of who was Lee Bowery.
Mm-hmm.
I stumbled upon him at a club, and then
In person.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, I went. No, I knew him, but I went to everything that
Which
he was.
Which club?
It was the first time I met him was at a defunct, now defunct, very, very odd movie house called Scala.
Okay. Which is now a house and drum and bass club. Is that the same one in London?
Must be. It used to be a place where animals were auctioned off for farms or some weird place where animals were auctioned off. And then it was turned into a movie theater. And in the hallway outside, Lee Bowery organized these parties. They were pretty small. That was sort of right at the beginning of when he was starting to do all of this. And I just happened to be there. And seeing him was transformative as well. I mean, that guy was so way out there. And that was social sculpture without any safety net. You know, when you're talking about social sculpture, like Joseph Beuys, for example, and you do this within the context of art, that's one thing, because you have a very secure safety net around you. When you dress like this and you actually in daylight walk around the streets of London in the early 80s, that's a whole different ballgame. And I thought that was so brave. And he was really, really just changing the way I thought about everything. And then during that time, I also went to a Fringe Theater Festival that presented Ethel Eichelberger's work. I didn't know anything about him, but a friend took me, and it was his rendition of Shakespeare's King Lear, in which he played most of the central roles, sometimes simultaneously, which made for very schizophrenic theater. But it was so amazing and playfully intelligent that I decided to go the next day again, which was actually quite an investment because I had to go back to Oxford and come back to London and find a place to stay and so on. But it was worth it. It was the same, officially the same play, but because the audience was different, he just improvised from beginning to end in order to get the kind of connection with the audience that he was seeking. So he really used the structure of this play as a means to connect with the audience. And that had a profound effect on me. I think that was sort of the first time that I came upon someone who presented a different model for art making, something that was much more ephemeral, that invested in something much more ephemeral. So I never actually met him, talked to him, but when I eventually made my way to New York, he and people like him were sort of part of the draw to experience people like that. And, you know, I saw a fair amount of him and people like him in the early 90s.
Where were you going in New York?
I was at Hunter College.
But I mean, like, what venues were you checking out?
The Pyramid Club. And he was working in something with Quinton Everett.
He's another guest we've had on the show.
Really?
Everett Quinton, yep.
Everett Quinton, yeah. I'm dyslexic. Yeah, no, he's another genius, and the Ridiculous Theatrical Company. And Ethel Eichelberger was involved with that as well. And various other venues, Wigstock.
Mm-hmm.
But it was actually during one of those Wigstocks when I think Lady Bunny announced that he had committed suicide because he had AIDS. And that sort of led to 10 years of knitting.
So where did the connection between knitting and Ethel Eichelberger come from?
In the most sort of obvious ways, Ethel Eichelberger, besides being a performance artist and playwright, was also a drag queen, or at least he used drag, male and female drag, as a very potent tool. So there was that gender confusion, and I thought it'd be sort of an apt tribute to knit. I'd never knit before.
But you knit Mylar.
I knit Mylar eventually.
Okay.
But I looked, when it all started, actually, I was still at school. I was still painting. I was making abstract, colorful paintings. And I wanted to do something out of the ordinary as a meaningful tribute, you know. It was just a personal thing. because I didn't want this death to go by. There were so many people who were dying from AIDS, but he was the most direct access point to AIDS for me, and it really shocked me and scared me, and I didn't want to let this beautiful life just sort of go by. So I wanted to do something meaningful, and in the spirit of his work, which was very makeshift and, you know, anything goes. And so I looked around the studio and to work with a different kind of material. I found a stack of transparent tape, could have been anything though. And I ended up making with this tape sort of a larger than life flower that I suspended in the air. And that piece, because it was radically different from everything that I had made up to this point, mm-hmm. Felt like it was the first piece that I'd made that actually needed to exist. And while that should have made me feel great, it did the opposite, because everything up to this point suddenly felt less meaningful.
Yeah, but how old were you?
I was in my early 20s.
Okay, so...
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, everything is so dramatic when you're that old. you always think you're dying at 30. And, you know, people around me were dying at that age. So I think death and mortality were very much on my mind, and I just didn't want to waste time. And I still don't. I work like mad because life is short. I've seen that many, many times. And as I grow older, you know, that sense becomes more acute. So I want to lead a meaningful life. And everything that I do is sort of geared towards that, to be honest.
And do you think that in 2002, do you feel like at a certain point you need to make a break from the knitting pieces and the Ethel Eichelberger work and sort of start something new? Is that because it's another radical change from video and performance or performative work from physical, sort of, even though ephemeral, but still object?
The knitting went through my relationship to knitting these sculptures went through many transformations. My attitude had to be flexible, because the process is so mindless. You make a stitch, you subtract a stitch, you begin, you finish, that's it. Mm-hmm. That was the range.
Well, that's very task in, task out kind of thing too.
Yeah, but I mean, there is no flexibility. My mind could, you know, race 100 miles a minute, but what I was doing was so mundane and so focused.
Did it make you feel better?
Oh, well, the idea at first was to do something with my hand, because I needed to figure out how to proceed, because this piece landed in my landscape like a UFO, this flower. And I needed to figure out how to move forward. Should I go back to painting or not? And I couldn't really make a snap decision on that, because it seemed profound. So what I needed was time. I needed to buy myself some time. And I came up with this idea, which in retrospect seems really very smart, but it was anything but. It was just sort of a guttural reaction. I thought, okay, I had made this flower out of transparent tape. Let's use this as a base material and work it in a way that allows me to let my mind figure this out while my hand produced something. You have to remember, I was also still at school. Mm-hmm. I couldn't just drop out. So I needed to produce something.
How very German of you to think that way.
Well,
I couldn't leave
very
school, so I'll just knit all day.
Well, you know, these things cost money, especially for foreign students. Yeah. And, you know, I didn't have much money. So I was aware of having to pay these things, and I didn't just want to bum around. Yeah. So I also, you know, the teachers that I was working with had invested in me.
Who were you working with?
I was working first with a painting professor named George Hoffman, and then I think another painter named Tom Weaver and Joel Carrero and a bunch of teachers who were teaching there at that point. And I lost my train of thought, but I wanted, you know, I had relationships with them. They had invested in me, and I also wanted to, work. Look, once I make up my mind, and I had made up my mind that art was probably going to be my path, then, you know, I just worked and pushed hard. And the knitting was actually a really great way to produce something, while it allowed my mind to figure out what to do next. But then as I made these pieces, they took on a life of their own. And to go back to your question, I just remembered it, about transitioning into video. Eventually, because what I was doing really was excessive and boring, you know, like anything excessive, it becomes unhealthy. And I felt I was shutting myself off from the world around me and wanted to connect more actively with the world. The knitting really was me in my headspace, and I came up with all kinds of tricks to connect what I was doing to the outside world, like approach this as performance or approach this as a form of activism or so on. And these little tricks helped me to not only stay more responsible to what I was doing because I felt there was this audience, but also kept me less in solitude. But eventually, you know, that ran its course and I needed to connect with other people. So I think it was in 2000 when I slipped a disc in my neck. Mm. And that created a natural break, literally. And I was actually really happy, not just because I was hopped up on painkillers, but I knew this was a great moment to shift focus. And, you know, I also pinched a nerve in one of my arms and couldn't actually knit. It was because my arm was in a sling. So I got a video camera that I could hold with the other hand and started to experiment. And as soon as I did that, because I was in a neck brace, I couldn't really be in front of the camera. I could only move very carefully behind the camera or press the button, you know. And so I needed other people. And as soon as people came into my studio and worked with me, there was no way back. That was it. I never really went back. Well, I briefly went back to knitting because I had certain commitments, but it ran itself out after about a year. And then I focused entirely on video, and then the video really became about people, and then everything else sort of followed out of that, including Task.
Yeah. And the Task party will be on September 6th in Madison Square Park.
Yep.
This is Will Corwin for Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org. And my guest today has been Oliver Herring, the artist. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks. That went by fast.